beyond Madrid, Louisiana, and Penn State, and Morelia. I think it's about a couple of minutes after. Couple of minutes after that. So, can you start now, Oren?
Sure, let's start. Okay, so here we go then. Hello everyone first, and it's nice and great to know that you are hearing me from far away. So here's the title, the second theory is for the continuum limit for loop quantum gravity, and it's going to be with special emphasis in what happens to quantum independence, because this is we introduce some extra structure, and the main motivation of the second part of the talk is to see what happens with this extra structure in the moment that we analyze the background independence. Okay, and this works in collaboration with Elisa Manrique, and here's the outline of the talk. Now in the second stage. Okay, first I'm going to say why I'm going to do what I do, what is my main motivation, and where I want to apply it. I go to see in this what problem in this setting what problems are the main open problems that motivate what I'm going to do in the middle of the talk. And then I'm going to specify in the number two how is that we have a general research plan and what we have done and what are our objectives and what I'm going to talk about today is going to be at the end of that second point. Then I'm going to talk about background independence at the end. Okay, the next slide is to just start the motivation. First, what are the static theories? What do I want to apply this machinery to? The target theories are loop quantized theories, any loop quantized theory. And now, it's not only gauge theories now, no? Even though they are the more important ones, we have developed for scalar fields and a bunch of other things that are now called polymer representations or loop quantized. So, first is the most important one that we have in mind, but not in the short term, but more in the long term, or in the medium term, is gravity. And it's really our main objective. But if we really want to study also other H theories, when they are coupled to gravity or when they are not coupled to gravity too. And then some will have a background, and some will not have a background, and we want to apply our machinery to all of them. So we will also, we already applied some scalar fields, and there are also model theories, lower dimensional gravity, or 2D Young Mills, or some model of quantum mechanics. And in particular, in this talk, we're going to study the background independence, just trying to have a model that gravity without the dynamical constraint or the scalar constraint, and that's called the Eisenhower model. Okay, the next slide is going to be the outline of the talk. Now I'm going to talk about the background independence of that one has in usual loop quantum gravity, loop quantization. So I put the independence in quotes because we obviously do use a background, and the background that we assume is a manifold, a 3D manifold. So we have, really, we are thinking about just a manifold without a fixed metric. And when one wants to be precise, we can say whether we are talking about the smooth category, the analytic category, or piecewise analytic, or linear, piecewise linear, So there are many options in the small letters of the approach. We won't have to specify what to be precise. The other important thing about background independence is that the true quantum gravity has a great feature of being able to represent a diffeomorphism group. So it consults a Hilbert space and a representative group of sigma in between quotes, because again, one qualifies if it's T infinity or T omega or what. And also part of the quotation marks comes from that the diffeomorphism group. It is not like the one we know in the classical physics, because somehow has a discrete action in the Hilbert space. And just I mean that if you have a state and you move it slightly with the diffeomorphism, it really becomes orthogonal to the original state. So there are no generators in this diffeomorphism group. So it's a discrete group when it starts on H sigma. So the important thing of this diffeomorphism in gravity is that they are gauge. So one really has to mod out by this transformation. And loop quantum gravity has found a way to do that with the loop averaging technique. So this kind of a sum of error orbit implementation. And this is remarkable for this, that it really needs some kind of renormalization, because the volume of the deep orbit is missing. And I like to know, since I've not seen almost any papers on out there, are you still hearing correctly?
Yes.
Yes. And I believe if you have any questions, feel free to interrupt in the middle. Soon it's going to end this introductory part, and then it will be very important that I have feedback, because it's not that I don't know if you are understanding. Okay, go to the next slide.
Jose Antonio,
yes?
Whenever you have any slide, please explain every symbol on the slide. That is
okay. Okay. Now I was in the slide that says background independence. The only symbol that has to be explained was that I call the Hilbert space of the loop quantum gravity H sigma. And I'm going to be going back and forth from H to the state of cylindrical functions. I'm going to explain a little bit more about that when I come out of the motivation. So these are two vector spaces where we represent things, and they are slightly different. One is the completion of the other one. And when I mention here HD, it's just the state of solutions of the ones that are the states that are diffeomorphism invariant. And it's going to be important to say things about this equation there, or that I wrote, this mathematical expression. But I'm going to explain it later on. So now I have come out of this slide. This slide over where it says open program. Okay, I'm in the slide with title open program. And the open program here, dynamics comes as the major open program, not that it has not been studied and completely finished in one particular way by Zeeman, but you see there are questions about the physical correctness of that implementation. So in particular, I want to mention not about the particular Zeeman strategy, but about a feature of quantum gravity, why it's so difficult to see the growing of the dynamics. And that is because the point of splitting regularization that we use many times, it doesn't do its job as it does in other field theories. Here, when, because of that, there are things that we are working with loops that are one-dimensional objects, and as soon as we move in slides, they become orthogonal states. Things that intuitively will converge, they don't. Here, so after we do some regularization, we have an expression as a limit when some little loop shrinks to being just a point. All these expressions don't converge on H sigma because of that discrete character that we have. And so other open problem that I'm going to make that is important for my motivation is that everyone is now trying to study the semi-classical limits or macroscopic limits, Newtonian limits, or somehow think out that the standard low energy physics can come out of this kind of quantum field theory that we work on. And these two points are really separate, that is major open big problems that motivate what I'm going to do. So I can invent another smaller problem motivated by these two big ones. Now go to the next slide. I'm going to say the research plan. And so the transparency is called, we have a title called structural development. So what we have done in the research plan is that we already developed some structures that they are really an implementation of Wilson's randomization group. And we think that it's tailored to loop quantization. So first, we developed we proposed the notion of measuring scale. And by that, I mean that when one is in a real situation, in a hypothetical lab, one only has finitely many or discretely many things that one can measure. And we say that these things are going to be the important scale, a measurement scale. I'm going to talk on that with care later. And once we have specified this notion of measurement scale, we develop an effective theory tailored to that scale, and we also include a regularization that is we can write in that effective theory expression we already have several effective theories, one at each scale. We are interested to see the relation, and the relation comes from a coarse grain map that is really a destination that we haven't presented. Now we know all the scales at which people could measure things and the relation, then what we want to do is to talk about a big meta theory that is the continuing theory, what we are going to call the continuing theory. That is one theory such that with the knowledge of that theory, you could project to the effective theory. That is, if you know all the microscopic details, you should be able to explain physics at any given scale. And so that theory that can give you the information for all the theories at any given scale, that's going to be called the continuum. And we are going to talk about observables there and how we construct them by randomization. Okay, so the next slide is now for the overall picture. Okay? Go to the time with title of the whole picture. So first, the objective. What we want to apply these quantum field theories and these techniques for, and we want to apply it to all the quantum this theory is the design of a magnetic path background to set the method. I mean, Sally said at the beginning that we want to implement a way to do quantum field theory for manifolds that don't necessarily have a background metric. That doesn't mean that they cannot have one. It's important to apply it to manifolds with a metric, so we can test with other quantum field theory and quantum quantization techniques that are developed and they are well established and they compare to nature correctly. So we should apply our tools to this kind of theory. And then also we want to start exploring the current quantum field theory in the absence of a background metric. And obviously our main goal is gravity coupled to matter, but that's going to wait a little bit more. So we are going to reconsider simple models that have already been developed by loop quantization techniques. And we are going to see what our structure can say about this implementation of Gibson renormalization. So now I'm going to change slides to explain what today's question. So what is that? Say today's question. Today's question is going to be to study what happens with the quantum independence after I be the structure that is going to be necessary to specify what's a measuring scale. To specify a measuring scale, I'm going to add some extra sources to the manifold that was not there, and then what happens with the background independence after I put this background. Am I going to be able to take that structure away or take a continuous limit properly, or am I going to be left with some residues of that? And the question is very much in analogy with the one that is a few theory people ask when they are studying if giving a field theory with the rotational symmetry, for example. So they know that there is not a lattice intrinsic to the nature of the system they are studying, and they want to know if when they finish their study, if they are going to have a theory, a quantum theory that is rotationally symmetric or not. And remember that this is slight difference because in gravity we don't really have a visual symmetry but visual gauge. But anyway, the question is in some sense symmetric. So that's going to be the main focus of the last part of the talk. And just we have to keep it in mind for some minutes now. And next, transparency is already starting with the explanation of the structures that we have developed. So go to the next slide to blue side of the measurement scale. But what I'm going to be talking on for now, this middle part of the talk, is about the structures that we developed and how it has been implemented this Gibson renormalization in a way compatible with loop quantization. So we start now with the state of cylindrical functions. And I think most people know what they are, but they are functions on the connection. In this case, we are going to be talking about gravity. So we have a manifold, sigma, in which there is a connection, an SU2 connection, to be precise. And so one can consider holonomies along loops. So a way to construct functions on this state of connection is to have some loops drawn on the manifold, and then measure their holonomies that are engaging variant things that take the place of the holonomy, and then that's an invariant. And one can consider then a function of that place of the holonomy, and that's what I call phi, for example. Yeah? And And so there are many physical functions on the manifold that one can consider like that. We are just putting node loops or also putting some label graphs with colors that are called pin networks. And when I put this J or K, that's what I have in mind, some pin networks. And so it's a graph that has some coloring, and that's the label that specifies what the cylindrical function I'm talking about. That's also a function of the connection, but depends on the connection in a very particular way. It doesn't depend on the connection anywhere outside of the drawn graph. Okay, so here is the big, the main point of the talk. If you don't understand what this measuring scale, you are not going to understand the rest of the talk. What we do now is to say that one is trying to measure the cylindrical function, but to decide in what state the field is. And then it's not a complete measurement, you can only measure partially. Okay? And what we are going to do is to imagine that the measuring device is really a cellular decomposition of the manifold. In particular, okay, today I'm going to just do very simple complete thing. And what I'm going to do is to put an initial triangulation of the manifold that I call delta. And that's the delta I want to subdivide by intensity subdivision many times, and n, the scale is going to be specified by n. What I mean is how many times I've done by intensity subdivision on the triangulation delta. So here in the picture, I have a manifold with a triangulation delta that I have subdivided once. So this is for n equal to 1. And then that's where my effective theory is going to happen, in that manifold with a triangulation that is the LP1. Okay? And there are many cylindrical functions that are identified. Here is the picture. Presents two different loops labeled with the same color, say J equal to 1/2. Yes, and for the purposes of the effective theory, they are going to be indistinguishable. And I'm going to explain it a little more in the next slide. So this is the spirit of the top. The measuring scale is going to be given by this subdivision of the manifold as a triangulation that is going to make the theory combinatorial in a way. Okay, so next slide.
Are you explaining to us a map? José Antonio? There was a map.
Yes.
In the last.
The map? Oh, the map is going to be the subject of the next three slides.
Okay.
The map is coming. Okay, so we are now in the slide entitled Effective Theories and Regularization. So first it says what the main structure of the loop quantization is this state of generalized connection. And this is to think about it with one base point that I call the star. And that state A mod G with the star is really the state of homomorphisms from the group of loops based on that star point to the group SU2. And it's important to know that the group of loops is only modulo of retracing. So thin loops don't matter. Okay, so we have that group and SU2 and the group homomorphism from there are really our connections modulo of H. Then here comes the origin of that map. What I'm going to do is that the group of loops, I'm going to make a map from that group to a small group called Pn of the scale n. And what it does is that from a loop, it assigns to it a sequence of cells in which it was. So, for example, if the loop starts in the in the triangle alpha 1, first, the first one of the first cell is alpha 1, and then it passes through the boundary between two triangles, and then it's alpha 2, and then goes to the next triangle, alpha 3, and like that, until it at the end closes. Okay, so alpha n is the same as alpha 1. And that's the mapping. And it is obvious that there are many different loops that have, that go to the same, it's a many to one map. So I'm dividing loops into given classes. So Pn is a, the elements of Pn are given classes of loops. In that same map, but now going in reverse, is the one that is going to give generalized connections, no gauge, from our connections at the module gauge at level n. And what is that? So at scale n, we again consider the group homomorphisms from Pn to SU2, and that's by definition the MOG n. And we can assign to it generalized connections, and what are they? They are simply colonomies, connections that assign the same polynomy to groups that are in the same equivalent class. Okay? And now we go to the next slide, and I'm going to be a little faster because I'm going to slow it. So now it comes to the cylindrical function. So here we have to dualize again after I explain the nature of the mapping on connections. Now the functions of connection go again in the direction from till sigma now to till n, and they come from that map that they explained already. And so that's the double dual kind of equivalent class map. Yes, and I'm not going to try to draw these two stars at the time, I'm just going to draw them from now on. That's what I'm going to do. So this map is very important to realize that it can be thought as a map from state to state, or better, from observable to observable. Yes, so it comes from the continuum, and it regularizes the observables, the cylindrical observables, to scale n. And there we are going to then work on scale n, and we are going to do quantization at scale n. Very much in the spirit of group quantization, but just now, this field n is very much like the state of functions on the last. Okay.
Can you tell us what is the structure on the space of connections A mod G at the scale n?
Is it you get a lattice that you get from a you can have a manifold, you make a triangulation, and there, the triangulation that's of scale n, there you can make a lattice gate theory associated to that triangulation, and really something that you define. And it's just the lattice gate theory of that lattice. What it means is that A mod Gn, it can give you the polynomials on any loop if you bring the connections to the continuum by the map I gave you, but also should be thought just as a lattice gauge theory.
Is the lattice gauge theory based on the dual lattice of the triangulation, or is the dual graph of the triangulation?
But it's not like, no, it's not really a dual lattice. If you want to be precise, you have to get the calculation that is called A, P, N of delta, and for that, you have to do again a bisecting subdivision to see what is that thing. So it could be A, P, N into the N plus 1. And then in that thing, you just see the lines and the lines and vertices, The last this theory there tells you all the information about the connection M of the N. And because in this M of the N, we have vertices that are the cells of the triangulation S the N. So for each cell, we have a vertex, if you want, like that. Anyway, let me go on a little faster because I see that I'm not going to arrive to the end that I want to. So here, basically, the method is just one last case theory associated to the calculation of scale n. Okay, now the same thing goes for the cylindrical function. And so what happens with the cylindrical function that scale in the continuum that goes to n? They just go many cylindrical functions to the same domain, to one map. That depends on if I get a spin network, how does this spin network intersect the circulation SGN? Okay? And if there are two that have the same intersection type, J and K that intersect the lattice in the same way, then we have two different cylindrical functions that go to the same cylindrical function scale n. Okay, now we go to the slide called effective theories and regularization. And I have here a triangle diagram. It's important to note that then I'm going to have this map, equivalent class. So if I have two different scales, m and n, and m is finer, that simply means that n is bigger, means finer, has more triangles. Then the map equivalent class of this bracket, so nm, regularizes from scale n to m. And basically, it's based in that the triangle diagram that is below commutes. Okay, so I can regularize in different ways and obtain the same thing. The second point here is that I can, if I vary the scale and I can get it as fine as I want, I can distinguish and separate different states. So if I have two different states, Φj and Φk, then they are going to have eventually a different regularization. Okay, so if that's clear, go to the next case, then to the next slide. And basically, what you're saying is that at one scale, we don't have all the information. But if we have information of all the scales, you will be able to recover everything that is said in the continuum. So the information that we have in the continuum is stored in the information at all the possible given scales. But the one state in a single one means a lot. I mean in the slide for approximation of functionals in the continuum. So now, just to explain this thing with an example, imagine that you are in the continuum and you have a Hamiltonian, and you want to take the expectation value of that Hamiltonian in a given state. So that functional that I call equal h of phi, I can approximate it using a function of that type at scale n. And the way to do it is following the diagram. So first I have the state I want to calculate the expectation value on, and I take it to space to sigma, to scale sigma, and then I calculate the so. The main point now is that if I have several of these functions Hn, I can compare them as what they would do on states in the continuum. And so it may be that I can produce a sequence of these Hn that converges. I think it's important to realize that it's completely different from the case where one seems to converge as one takes a limit and one takes the limit of suggested by the pond splitting procedure used in loop quantum gravity sometimes just as a motivation. But there the limit never works with H sigma or in C sigma. The limit that one that is suggested by loop by point splitting that doesn't converge, but these other limits they do converge many times. Okay, now I go to the next slide.
But what is the assumption on the Hamiltonian for this procedure to work?
There are many there are conditions. Sometimes it doesn't converge, sometimes it converges. Now it's just the preliminary thing about the limit that can exist. Later I'm going to give a complete procedure that suggests taking some limits and there is a code that is kind of limits of the type that converges. But now basically what I'm saying is that I'm not working here in skill, but if you see I'm working on the convergence that I'm talking about happens in skill. I'm talking about functionals on sigma. And what I'm saying is that these things have a much better chance of converging.
My question is
the things that appear naturally in what I'm going to say later.
My question is just what is capital H sub M?
What is happening? What? H sub N?
Yes.
N.
Capital.
I was giving you a procedure to do something, but I could, for example, regularize that have a Hamiltonian in the classical theory, in the continuum, and regularize it to scale N. And produce this functional Hn just like that.
Okay, so
at any n. Okay. And what I'm saying is that how can I compare different effective theories with different n? And there is going to be one way called for training that I'm going to tell you later, but I can also compare them as what they do to the continuum because I will produce the effective theories as kind of equivalent classes of theories that are appropriate to when you measure the continuum with a given sensitivity. So these are natural questions. And really what is going to happen many times is that to get convergence of things, one has to adjust some parameters. So that I'm going to talk about that in a few slides. Okay, so next comes the important ingredient called false graining and a definition map that I'm going to introduce. So this map goes in the opposite direction as the map that I had before that I called regularization. This one is called the false graining map. So I'm supposed to assign a state in the continuum in sigma from a state in field n. And the way to do it is simplified in the figure. The way to picture the spin networks of CLN is again graph labeled by colors. So now the graphs are should be thought as made of cells of the triangulation, that is triangles. And here I just drew with the red the dimension 2 triangles, but it should also be some dimension 1 and dimension 0 possible there, but I omitted them for simplicity. And so this loop that I put here in the screen, it should be marked to the continuum, and I have to decide where to put it. This is like when one is a kid in the newspaper and they tell you to join the dots that are there, you have to produce a loop and you choose a way to do it. Okay? So here, it depends on a choice. But the choice that we are going to do in this talk is the talk on the bicentric subdivision, so it's going to be the bicentric embedding. So each dot, I put it in the bicentric of the bicenter of the corresponding triangle, and I join it with a line according to the triangle. So the triangle itself knows what the straight line, and that's what I'm going to use. So in this talk, we are choosing to have our containing map drawn by this polycentric embedding. Okay, now what are the properties of the map? The one important property is this triangle diagram of this source for you. The only thing is that it is consistent with the regularization map, very much in the way that happens in fiber models.
Are you bringing in a background metric now?
What?
Are you using a background metric in order to do this embedding?
The thing that I'm using is that at this scale, I have a calculation there, and I'm using that calculation as a way to put the model it's a given structural pieces. So yes, I'm introducing not the background, and that's why there is the interest of the question that I'm going to address later, what happens with all these structures that I'm putting, because it really a lot of new things that were not in the manifold before.
Okay, but for the first match, the triangulation was only a topological triangulation. But now it seems to me that you are using
You are correct. The first map is just regularizes the manifold as a combinatorial simplicial complex, and that doesn't introduce a background metric. It does introduce a background in the sense that I could have shoved the manifold in different ways. So now, for the cross graining, I need a map that goes in this. With the arrow in this direction, and so what I have to do is to choose embedding, and the choice of embedding is huge, and it's always going to be introducing a background, because someone else could have introduced a different before planning map, and what I'm choosing to do this time is just to maybe another key, but just choose one that is tailored to the simplicial complex. And the way to do it is that the simplicial complex can be realized as an Euclidean in pieces, a piece of R to the end with a Euclidean metric, and then that's what I'm doing this time for this choice.
Okay.
Okay, now I'm going to talk about what happens to observables when I use for graining. And what happens is that first I regularize, let's say that here M is a K that is lower resolution than N. N is finer than N. So I regularize my theory at scale M, and then I produce this, in this example, again an H, some Hamiltonian that I'm going to compute the expectation value later. And so I have that regularization at scale n, and also I have it at a finite scale n, and the containing map is going to allow me to bring the information from the more microscopic scale to scale m. So what I do is I follow this triangle diagram, and what I produce is another theory for another function that has to do with the Hamiltonian at scale m, but that knows about some finer detail scale m. Of course, these two theories cannot be completely independent, because they are supposed to describe the same phenomenon. And what people do actually is that the two of them have some tunable parameters, and both of them have been tuned into the same. So HM and HN already agree by construction on a few things that they predict. And the question of whether what is correct in HM is in the other one. So one produces a effect theory HM by tuning a few parameters, and the rest of the things that one measures is prediction, And here, we introduce the correction summation. It is going to correct only that new prediction, and it's going to agree on the things that were already pre-fixed. So that's why we say that this constraint of the observable HN includes microscopic correction CHN. The next slide. Now we're going to talk with the continuum. The continuum, what was that? So at the scale M, we can study the convergence of the microscopic. So I'm still not asking questions about the continuum as what happens to still sigma. But I want to still be in the lab at scale M, and I want to have my best tool to do prediction. And so what I want to do is, I know now how to perform microscopic corrections, and I want to do that with finer scale. So I take this limit as when n goes to infinity, and if it converges, that means that I'm reaching an optimal theory at scale m. So it's the best theory possible at scale m. And that's what convergence means. Okay, now the next slide. The field of zeros in the continuum. Imagine that I have this optimal observable, the collection HM REN. REN is of renormalized. What happens when can I use them again to correct the theory that we find is at scale n? Can I use now a better correction from scale n and correct again? And the question, the answer is that no, they are all compatible. They agree in the sense of that formula that I have down here, that the constraint of a finite one is the important one, when they are already renormalized. And so this collection already knows about all the possible experimental settings of the class that I'm talking about. So in that sense, it's already the continuum, that collection of compatible renormalized theories. So in that sense, the continuum can be expressed mathematically in the equation or diagram that is at the bottom of the transparency. And what is the continuum then in this setting is this direct limit of still m. And that means that the space that belongs to that space, the space that are cylindrical at some scale n. So this collection of Hamiltonians can produce the expectation value in a given space. This class of states are states that belong to this direct limit. It's a limit that has a right pointing arrow. That one is called the direct limit, and the states of there are the appropriate states on which the collection of compatible collection of Hamiltonians can act. And I here have a comment that this state naturally can be injected into few sigma, but in fact it is only a little piece of few sigma. For example, it's separable. This is a very small piece of few sigma. What would happen? Can I somehow get the continuum to tell me things about few sigma? I'm quite talking about few sigma because I'm in the loop community here. Most people may not care about it. This already the other space, it is a space in the continuum, but this, for example, for symmetries or something, it's not as nice as still sigma. So next slide, please. Here I have another way to talk about observables in still sigma that is using the regularization map that I talked about before. So I have a state in still sigma, I put it into still n, and I'm going to be drawing the correct transparency, yeah, I don't know. So the observables in the continuum, and it has this triangles. So from T sigma to T len, and then from T len to T, just with this HN renormalized. And the question is whether these things are going to converge when n goes to infinity. And they do. They do for is the renormalized map in T. This diagram usually produces limits that exist. So I can use also this convergence. It's not a theory that it's always when the renormalized observer exists, this other limit always exists, but many times it exists and depends, and it is because usually one ends up with continuous mapping, but the edge there's a sort of continuity there, but this is not a theorem that this thing is always going to converge. It many times converges, and it is a sign of you have a theory that is not too wide. Okay, next transparency is called I'm going back now. Going forward to the last section that is for the study of Kakao in the findings. Okay, and so now is the main, with the previous transparency, I finished saying about the general framework that we introduced, and now I'm going to study what happens with Kakao independence, given that I put all this extra stuff in the manifold. Okay, so I'm going to review what happens in Lucas and gravity proper, or standard, and what happens with the diffeomorphism invariant, the diffeomorphism constraint, the looking for solutions to that, you can take that are invariant on their ratios, and they don't belong to T sigma, but they belong to the dual. And there is a nice way to construct them called by a rigging map or so. And what he does is that it takes a clinical function and produces from it, using it as a key, and taking it with a moving it all around with the diffeo group, it produces with the torque some state in some function around sigma. And it is produced the idea of how it is done, it is in this equation between poles. And that's the question can be properly written, but I'm not going to do it today. It takes some time. So this is the basic idea of the group averaging technique applied to diffeo. Okay, it is worthy to mention that these sums are huge. They are very infinite in a way. So we have two different cylindrical functions that cannot be matched by any x. So, for example, if their graphs are not isomorphic, then this thing will be zero all the time. But when they are not, when they are in the same class, the sum here is infinite, uncomfortably infinite. So one has to do some proper dividing by infinity or something like that. Next slide. So in the score of that are diffeomorphisms, then what happens to diffeomorphisms at scale n or m? That's a question that if we know that our classical theory has this important symmetry or invariance, and we want to write an effective theory at a given scale, then the first question is what happens to the symmetry that I have after I quantize it in this case, what happens? I think what happens is that it's broken, but when I get all of the different scales, I can somehow recover it. So look at the diagram below. If I have a decimal system F from sigma to sigma, that thing induces mass that I call Fn in a different scale. Okay, but But it's important to notice that this collection of observables Fn is compatible in the sense that if I have the Fn, let's forget about the original F on C sigma, I can, if I have only Fn, I can from it reconstruct already Fn and all the ones, those the mapping F from further scale than M or N. So it is, they are compatible. From one single F, I generate a sequence, a collection of compatible maps. Another important thing is that these sets that I'm going to call this N, they are all finite. So that shown that I pointed out that they could be infinite, but in the continuum, at scale N is definitely not infinite because these sets, I don't call them groups because they are not natural groups. They are finite sets. And another important property is that if I have two different features in the continuum, F and G, then they are going to be differentiated eventually by at scale n. Here I wrote it as f equal to g, if and only if fn equals to gn for n. So in a sense I can recover the information in the continuum from the information in all the scales as I told before. The next slide. What I can say, even though I recover all the information from the distros, there are many inconveniences of thinking about given scale for different purposes. And so here is a list of them. At any given scale, we do not have a representation of this, because once we have thought that okay, you have this smaller space now till n, maybe there is a sigma there, but that is not faithful or something. Maybe there is a subgroup of this sigma that can be represented there or something. But in general, there is no such structure. So the next point is that even when in this space that I said that function is the continuum limit, even there, isomorphisms do not act in a proper way. Because as I put it, it's a particular subset of C sigma, and that set will not be left invariant by most details. So, since it depends on all the choices that I took, if I move with an issue, I move my choices, this background message that the virus was talking about, I move it and I arrive to some different state. So that state in the continuum is not good for talking about issues. So there is a representation that one could take in another space of the continuum, constructed with a little sigma, till n, but this other one. It's really a projective, constructed with a projective limit of not the map, containing map, but the regularization map. And this one is very big. In fact, one can naturally put C sigma inside of it. And there, yes, you can represent the isomorphisms. So if you eventually want to talk about isomorphism somehow in this setting, you should do it in this limit, although it's not as nice as this sigma by any means. Okay, then the next thing to say is that if I want to study the regularization and then renormalization of this, I guess that there are finite sums of the sum average. Of the visual group averaging was regularized, Then I encounter several obstacles. And one is that the number of coping constants, that is the one we call coping constants, is involved in the sum, they grow at n goes to infinity. And that never happens for us. And theory that there is a chance of being renormalizable. No? So here, what I call the coping constant is that in the sum, I can beat that here, that depend on the state that I have at scale n. And one could say, okay, why don't you just put them all to one or something like that? But that's not consistent in to see why not. Because here I'm summing over the set this n, and this set, again, this sum many times is going to be just adding zeros. So sometimes it's not adding zeros, and it's going to, the number of times that one can have non-zero contribution depends very much on the nature of the discretization or the regularization. So it is rather difficult. One would have to compensate with this coping constant, and this is a very difficult combinatorial problem that one would have to solve. Obviously, it's not a solution, because, for example, we could take the solution that's already known from sigma and pull it back. But anyway, that's not the purpose of doing this. The next thing in common that I put in this slide is that since the symmetry does not help when one restricts to a given scale, so let's say I want to talk about scale m, then should I encounter, or if I want to look for a nice effective theory there, it's usually done with certain level of accuracy on a truncation code. And so it has to be something that looks nice and has few tunable parameters. But what can I choose is usually from the support of symmetries. And here I don't have any symmetries that tell me that leave at scale n. And that's a big problem. And now I go back to this motivation that I had originally, that is to explore what happens to quantum independence. Here, add an analogy to what happens with rotational invariance in the string of quantum field theory with the lattice. This is what is the only difference, not the previous point. The string of quantum field theory in the lattice, it can be done, and it's done only when you can have these useful truncations that come because there are symmetries, there's some group of the translation group or something that lets you have only a few coping constants, and then you see what happens with what's left. No, but you're going to start with few coping constants, and here this symmetry is gone, so it's not very useful, I think, the state that it is. Okay, so now I'm going to now say some positive things in there. But this story of the negative things are just the ones that I'm going to help you think about one way to improve this strategy if you want to, because, I mean, you may not even want to continue in this particular line or study with this line background independent problems or diffeomorphism group average. Okay? So now the summary is the next slide. What we have done is with a single framework, that is this group quantum gravity plus some implementation of the Wilson renormalization group ideas, we have treated quantum field theories on metric and non-metric backgrounds. Okay, is we have we can compare with standard treatments and face one alternative treatment, and there is complete agreement. For example, we have done the 2D model, we have studied polymer quantum mechanics, we have done this polymer quantum mechanics some Corici talked about it some days ago. And it is a model theory that is not really quantum mechanics at the beginning, but then if you look at it closely, it is 2D and it is. And then there is 2D young meal that is also suitable by this model, by this way, I mean, a particle in this treatment. And there is CQPTs. And also now it is the HTTPS model with difficulty at the end. And in fact, there are some other things that I'm not mentioning here, that also one can learn of the successes and the difficult things. So for example, in CQPTs, also there are things that are very nice to say about this. Things and when there is agreement, but one has to do particular things to reach agreement, and one can really renormalize and right. So now, another point here is that the source of the difficulty in this problem of today came from the pool relation between the non locality of not classes, and our notion of measuring scale. So in one sense, these are the triangles that were fixed in the lattice, and this was in one place there. And on the other hand, you have not lattice that do not live in a particular space in the lattice, and they didn't seem to interact very well together. And I think here that in a different variant, the quantum field theory that doesn't see all the different not classes. For example, some invariant that may identify many not classes, but that could be calculated locally. So that seems to be much nicer because of our fixed calculation on the manifold. So anything that could be calculated locally is going to be not have this problem because of the treatment with the not classes that were not localized in the manifold. In particular, the theory that one has to deal with has something like different variants or even more, but that is local, then I see a much better, a much more promising future for that thing, because, for example, we can also in our have a case that they are refined locally. We can, in this day, I gave you the explanation only with scale n, so I have the scale labeled by the integer. But really, what I think from the set of scales is only a partial order, and I can then refine in some places and not in others, and they don't all have to be triangles. I mean, so this framework is much more flexible. And people have the same problem with the not classes, and that's why today I just presented that and not the false flexible framework. We will simplify the difficulty because that's not the problem today. And but in another quantitative theory that is interested only in calculating some things that are local, then I think we don't have much better chance. So that's this time. And now to the last slide, comes the acknowledgement. So this work was done with Elisa, and we both acknowledge the discussion with the people that are here below, Ramiro Bautista, Corici, Romero Diaz, Jorge Martinez, Claudio Menezes, Robert Otto, Tania Mistatina, and Axel Weber, and other people that I mentioned. Bye-bye. That's it. Questions, please.
to me, is it possible to switch off your microphone?
My microphone? Yes, let me see.
Okay, yeah, that's good. No echo now. So it seems to me that kind of the most useful application of effective theories in the framework of background independence and so on that we do in loop quantum gravity would be really to do something the other way around. Namely, you really want to start with some candidate theory and coarse grain and see what effective theories you get. The way you are doing it is really trying to define the theory via successive effective theories and quote-unquote looking at the renormalization group. But as you pointed out, at some stage in the construction, you are actually using, in the coarse graining procedure, you're using all kinds of background structures, and then you do not know if the results are going to be, you know, invariant under the choice of changes of these background structures. So it seems to me that a much more powerful application of this framework would be to do the other way around, namely consider some semi-classical states, in which case the semi-classical state might give you the background structure, and then use your technology to really coarse grain and get some effective theories with which you can then compare with experiments and so on. In particular, things like the Lorentz invariance violated in the effective theories and so on. Have you thought about such inverse application of your formalism?
Yes, I thought about it, but not very deeply. I mean, that was the original motivation of doing this, to look for the macroscopic limit, because that's how we started. But then, I got interested in this other aspect of in going to the continuum that I think is very rich, but the other aspect is also very interesting to me. And I have only some initial thing, and I want to work on that soon. But anyway, there is not much talk.
Okay, I have one more question if you could switch off your microphone. Okay, so
yes.
Actually maybe I should ask a couple of questions and then you can speak so we don't have to switch off the microphone. I mean, in your last but one transferences, which began with however, you point out this story about the coupling constants basically, and then you say that the coupling constants are constrained by a diffeomorphism invariant, but there is a complicated combinatorial equation to solve. My question really here is that does one even know that the solution exists or is it unique, forgetting about actually obtaining it? So this is my first question. My second question was really the level where we, early on, when you define kind of Hamiltonians, H sub m, at some scale n of discretization. The question really is that is there any relation between, for example, those Hamiltonians, supposing I want you to do it in loop quantum gravity, so is there any relation between those Hamiltonians and the continuum Hamiltonian, or the, what you would call continuum Hamiltonian, that is obtained by, for example, Riemann-like procedure or algebraic quantum field theory programs of Riemann, etc., etc.? The last question is really that at many stages you said this procedure always works, but the question is really whether it works in cases which are not just topological field theories. Okay, these are the three questions.
Okay, my memory is very bad, so I start with the last one, and then try to recover the other question. And I think that what Thomas did when he produced his Hamiltonian was to somehow start with a regularization given a triangulation, no? And then work on that. So here the aspect is already the same. Say here he produced his first thing, that it's really a Hamiltonian that is completely ambiguous or flaring. and see what happens. So what happens in how Osama solves his problem is that he says that the Khan historian doesn't act on the kinematic active space, but only on the deep environment in the space of solutions to the video. So we could do the same. We could do the same there. And here we could have the question would be whether we are gaining anything. And the natural thing to study in our framework would be to, now that we have the popularization of the talk at each scale, what happens when you portray? I cannot say the story in detail, but it doesn't look like something terribly bad is going to happen. But to have agreement, there is going to have to be some tunable parameter somewhere. And here, that's the issue. What are you going to do with this realization that don't obviously have a tunable parameter? But we want to try to work on those lines. In fact, we are not on that problem, but some much simpler problem related to what happens when you work with trying to define observables depending on the curvatures. That is really what's happening. Also, you have an expression, classical expression that depends on the curvature, and you regularize it and depends on colonomies, and so what do you have? And that's an interesting thing to study, I think. And I think there is a relation to what those people have to study. I have not before, but I'm doing work on that with my student Romero. Other questions, I remember the first question that you said that was about whether there are solutions to these combinatorial restrictions on the coupling constant. And what I want to point out is that once there is as you said, once you have a theory in the continuum, I can constrain it to any scale. So since the inductive averaging formula exists in G sigma, I can constrain it to by construction, then they are compatible, that's already renormalized. And in a sense, that's the solution. The thing is whether it looks at any scale like an effective theory, and no, it doesn't, because it's already a renormalized theory. So the answer seems to be that there is no simple thing at any scale, but there is a complicated formula at any scale that is the cross grain of the deep averaging formula there. So, and it is pretty obvious what to do. You take your case at stage till n, and you put them in the continuum in till sigma using the constraint map, and there you ask with the group of energy formula and see what happens. So it tells you whether there is something different from zero, and if they are not isomorphic, then it's completely zero. Within the framework, there is slightly richer answer that says that since I showed you that, I didn't really show it in detail, but I told you that there was a secret space that could be constructed from this space here N as a projected limit using the regularization map. Anyway, in that space, the action of figures and there, one could do the same thing that people do in loop quantization in still sigma there, but I don't see any novelty in that, just that the possibility is there. So you can talk about behavior in that place. I think exactly that place where we could talk about rotational symmetry in natural theory in the continuum limit, when you are studying some incidental theory that means, in that analogy, work in that state where we would have to work the detail thing as well too. So it exists and it's there, but as far as regularization or simple effective theory at scale M or N, there is no such a thing. Okay, now we go to the second question. Could you remind me the second question?
No, it's okay. I think we're running out of time. So let us ask if there are other people who have questions. Okay, Jorge, any announcement?
No.
So let us thank Jose Antonio again because we are running out of time for the bridge.
Okay, bye-bye.